Tuesday night edition of the pod got a big celebrity guest coming up, Rich Cho, Charlotte Hornets GM and food blogger extraordinaire. But first, I want to talk about what was a really fascinating game between the Thunder and the Jazz, and also get to a little news, see how long that takes us. Might even do a question or two, random question between me and Danny. But let's get started with this game. 100-94, the Thunder took it, overcoming a 17-point deficit to beat the Jazz. Thunder really looked dead in the water late in the third quarter. How are they able to come back, Danny?
To me, it was about defense. I thought that they did a much better job in that second half, making the Jazz take harder shots and then reaping those rewards sometimes in transition. And I'm sure a lot of people point to Russell Westbrook, and I'm completely fine with that. He did have some big moments, certainly. He had a great final line in the game, 34, 13, and 14, which is just ridiculous. That's Russell Westbrook. But for me, especially at the beginning of the fourth quarter, this was about defense.
Yeah, at a time when Westbrook was not in, and despite his best efforts, they started that fourth quarter down 12 and actually made up 6 points of that deficit without him before he came back. And then it was actually, I agree with you, it was the defense. It's a really odd game because at halftime, the Jazz led it 47-39, and it was a crazy fast game. 52 possessions for Utah, 53 for OKC. OKC managed only a 74 offensive rating and continuing their offensive struggles. And I agree with you, their defense holding the Jazz to the 12 points in the fourth was huge. But the first half was so weird because of the turnovers. Utah had 13 steals in the first half. They stole the ball from the Thunder on 24.5% of the possessions. And then the Thunder had 7 steals right back from the Jazz as well. So, and nobody was getting on the offensive glass. So all that leads to very short possessions when you're getting it stolen before you can shoot and you're not extending possessions with offensive rebounds, but nobody had any efficiency at all. And the Thunder just could not hit a jump shot. They were 4 of 21 on jump shots in the first half, despite getting a few inside. And then when the Jazz really broke out to that 16-point lead in the third, they were humming from three-point range. OKC's offense still looked terrible. And then it took Westbrook really starting to go into hero mode to bring them back late in the third.
And Westbrook's shots in the third were fundamentally different, because what it looked like to me was that they were letting him get a little bit more loose to the middle of the floor. And so he was taking those kind of out free throw line pull-up shots. And yeah, I mean, there is the demerits that are on mid-range shots, but if you're getting open ones from mid-range, especially somebody who can make those, who can make them uncontested, then it's a fine shot. I love it when guys can create layups or create fouls or things like that. But he was getting into rhythm on those, and then that helped open up some of the other stuff. And then another big difference in the second half was Steven Adams' offensive rebounding. Adams had 5 offensive rebounds in the second half. And that's against a Utah front line that had at least Gobert or Favors out there. And it wasn't actually that much of both of them, at least the beginning, because in that third quarter, it didn't seem like Quinn Snyder could go away from it fast enough.
Yeah, and that was the case as well in that game against Washington. Starting those guys, it's completely nominal at this point. He took Favors out less than 3 minutes into the second half. Those guys started together and played a mere 5 minutes together. It's the most comical front court starting, quote unquote, pairing since Bogut and Dirk played together in the front court last year. And finally, Bogut, who is probably a little, I don't want to say less prideful, but a little bit more self-aware about these kind of things maybe than a lot of people, was like, hey, it's ridiculous to start me and then take me out of the game a minute later, so why don't you just start Dirk and I'll come off the bench. But you know, Derek Favors doesn't feel this way, and he was playing extremely well obviously before then. They did close the game with Rudy Gobert instead, but I agree with you. You know, Adams, 20 points, 9 of 10 from the field, had the 6 offensive rebounds in the game, was really a huge difference maker, because especially late, he really, when it was close, that's how the Thunder were able to score in the last couple of minutes. And he really dominated Rudy Gobert, who's just returning from that knee contusion.
He also had 10 screen assists in this game, which is one of the higher totals I can remember in a single game. And some of that is just you set a screen for Russ and he's going to shoot it, but it can work out. And I thought the other big takeaway in this game was that Donovan Mitchell was given a really, really tough assignment in this game. He was largely guarding, a lot of times he was guarding Paul George, and even more of the time he was being guarded by Andre Robertson. That is an unenviable double if there ever Trevor Ozwan, and he had just a really nice game overall. It wasn't the setting necessarily setting the world on fire like when he scored 41.
No, this is setting the world on fire. You put up 31 points on 22 shots.
Yeah, that's
shots.
True. Where I was going was like the box score stats weren't there, but in some ways this was more impressive to me. That's where I was going, but I agree with you. Like, that's how I took it.
Yeah, he also had 4 assists and 5 steals. He threw 4 or 5 great passes. That actually was probably the most impressive thing, you know, as someone who I have not seen as many games of the Jazz during this recent run. And so locking in on him, he really had some beautiful passes, a few of which were flubbed. He had a couple to Favors on just straight penetration where he's able to find him and Favors got stripped. He threw this one pass and it actually was a little low. It was late in the clock. He was driving in from the left side and somehow he like turned his right hand, it looked like backhand, and threw the pass completely across the court to Joe Ingles in the corner. And I've never seen anyone really throw a pass like that before, but it was a little bit low. So Ingles wasn't able to convert it and they ended up, I think, getting a shot clock violation on that possession. But I'd never seen that sort of imagination in a pass before from him. And so that was all very impressive. And then just the ability to get up those 12 three-point shots. Matt Harpering was all over this on the broadcast, and it's something that we've been discussing since we first saw him in Summer League, that his ability to rise on balance, you know, really maybe the only other guy in the league like that to me right now is Klay Thompson, who can really be going full speed and nearly always manages to square up with his footwork. And Mitchell has even more rise on his jump shot than Thompson does. And the other guy, I was saying this on Twitter the other day, who Mitchell kind of reminds me of at 6'3", at least offensively, because he's a much better defensive player than this guy, is Gilbert Arenas. And not like a conventional point guard type player, but a guy who's pretty good off the dribble. He gets to the rim, can jump, can finish. And then Gilbert had like pretty similar shot form to Mitchell as well. Just a very, very compact stroke, quick release, squared up, on balance all the time when he shot it. And, you know, not maybe incredibly efficient, although Mitchell certainly has improved his efficiency lately, but a guy who's been able to create shots basically whenever he wanted to. I mean, and I thought it was just against this caliber of defense. He did have a few foibles late and he ended up having 5 turnovers, but for a rookie being asked to be the primary creator on this Jazz team, incredibly impressive performance from him tonight. And he's been incredible really over these last few games.
And at 21, he is older than some rookies, but it's not like he's this appallingly old rookie at all. And his physical talent, I think that he's going to be able to get so much better. I don't know what his ideal role is offensively. And if you think of his defensive ceiling, you can't really reach that if you're as active offensively as he might end up being. You can only look at the guy who was across the court from him in this game, Russell Westbrook, who was a dominant defender until he became a huge offensive player and stopped caring as much about defense. And so I think that Mitchell just has this sky high potential. And I remember he was just below the threshold of guys that we really focused on because we've spent so much time watching the NBA
video. Really, I was right, and I'll explain why I was skeptical about him, because like he wasn't able to be efficient really at Louisville. You know, I mean, he was hitting like you know, low 30s on 3-pointers. His shot selection wasn't great. One of the things that Mike Schmitz highlighted was that he can't jump really off of 1 foot. He's more of a 2-foot jumper. And I've been really impressed by, you know, because he's got those long arms, he still can't jump off of 1 foot, but he's able to get great extension now with 1 foot. He's really worked on those plays. And so he has become a much better finisher since even the start of the season as he's adapted to NBA defense. So that's been impressive as well. I just really like, and I didn't think his shooting was going to hold up because he just didn't really shoot it that well in college. But, you know, even though his shot looked good, this is one of those ones where it's like, okay, you know, I know it looks great, but hey, guess what? Like, the stats aren't there. But, you know, he started off shooting poorly from three, but I think he's now up over 37% from downtown for the season.
I just looked it up, and my first tweet about Donovan Mitchell at Summer League, which was the first time we saw him in person, but the first time I ever really saw him for an extended period, was just, Donovan Mitchell can play, capital P-L-A-Y. And I was just, it was really impressive.
Yeah.
And he's just phenomenal.
Yeah. And we'll see how it goes for him the rest of the season. But, you know, we kept saying, all right, you know, chill out, he's going to regress, and he continues to play better, you know. And we'll see if he, you know, when he gets on scouting reports, and like, you know, it'd be rare for a rookie to continue playing this well. But, you know, as you mentioned, he is a little older. So is Ben Simmons, actually. Those guys are about the same age, as I recall. So that's been great. Let's talk a little bit about how the Thunder made their comeback, though. I mean, Anthony and Paul George combined for 9 points in the first half. And then as the Thunder went out and scored 61 points in the second half at a very slow pace, by the way, as well. In the second half, it was much slower. They were down, I think, around 45 possessions. So they absolutely dominated offensively, in part due to that offensive rebounding from Adams. Westbrook going off, turning the Jazz over, getting out in transition. I thought the Jazz didn't do nearly good enough of a job of not guarding Roberson, who was plus 14 in 34 minutes and only forced to take 2 field goal attempts, none of them jump shots. Thunder got absolutely nothing out of their bench once again, although I guess maybe that's not fair to say because they were in there when they made a little bit of a comeback at the start of the fourth, but statistically the bench wasn't very good. But I thought really what changed it, and Matt Harping, the Jazz announcer, was all over this, was that they just started playing harder. And I think the Jazz, on a back-to-back tough flight from Utah, lose an hour going east to OKC, that they ran out of gas a little bit late, although again I thought it was a lot of it was their offense. And then also just Gobert is not there yet. Like he this is just his second game back. He played interesting that he played a back-to-back in his first two games back, and so I thought he really, especially on the defensive glass, and then also his activity around the rim, whenever he comes back from these injuries, you know, he's not quite the same player. This is the third time we've seen him come back from, you know, a moderate knee injury like this, and especially to see him get dominated on the glass by Adams was atypical for Rudy.
Especially in the first half of a season, you're learning something about teams all the time, and something that I walked away from this game, which paralleled the Detroit-Philly game from Saturday, I believe, was that I walked away from this game feeling better about both of these teams. OKC is like, okay, you know, we knew their defense was for real, but they, you know, they had better, their offense in clutch was way better than it was before, much more egalitarian, and some of that was that they, you know, they created one-on-one, like that beautiful spin move that Melo had on Joe Ingles, and then ended up getting, I think he scored, yeah, he scored that one, and there was another one that was a nice tip play, but they were able to do that. And then Utah, I mean, you could see in this game, remember, they're still without Joe Johnson, they're also without Rodney Hood, granted, Mitchell's playing well, Alec Burks has had some really nice run as well, not necessarily in this
Burks
game, but
had
just
scored,
overall.
I think, over 20 points the last three games before this, although he shot poorly in this one, did get to the foul line well.
Right, so like, did you feel the same way I did, where it's like, I think I got a, I feel like both of these teams are better in my eyes after this game?
Yeah, I think so, although, you know, Utah, I remain skeptical, I mean, especially with the way they've shot the ball from downtown. The fact that they're able to get up a lot of three-point attempts on this good OKC defense is good. They can feel good about that, and they have solid shooters from downtown, and as they always are, you know, they're missing a couple of key guys. Joe Johnson, I mean, forget he's even on this team anymore. He's been out for a while. And I think I'm a little skeptical about their ability to score against really good defenses, and we saw that in the second half here as well, and it didn't help that they, I mean, at some point they have to go to a lineup like this, but they had a lineup with Cephalosha, Rubio, and Gobert all out there with Burks, and I can't remember who the last guy was, maybe it was Joe Ingles, but that was a lineup that really struggled to score down the end of the third quarter. And then without Mitchell again at the start of the fourth, they only had 2 points, I think, in the first 6 minutes of the fourth quarter as the Thunder were able to get back in contact. Couple other things here too. OKC, this is an action if you want to see it on film. Ben Falk wrote about this in one of his recent pieces, that they ran a play down the end of the fourth they actually had some pretty good effectiveness with. It's called Hawk, basically, where, named after the cut, they'll start off with all three of their stars on the strong side, with Russell Westbrook having the ball, Roberson and Steven Adams on the weak side. Paul George will get a back screen from Melo, similar to, like, you know, a UCLA kind of back screen, you know, if you're familiar with that. And then immediately after receiving that back screen, presumably Melo's man has to go help on George a little bit on the back screen. And then Melo will go immediately into a pick and roll with Russell Westbrook. And so the idea being that Melo's man is off of there, and then he's not able to step up and play good pick and roll defense against Russ, and then George will come off a double pin down on the opposite side with Steven Adams and Roberson setting the screen for him. And they never really got into the action with George swinging it to the weak side, but they were able to go to Melo in the post. That was how they got that spin move that you talked about, where he beat Joe Ingles for the and one. He got another nice ISO jumper as well. Russ was able to get into the lane a couple of times too, with a pick and roll afterwards. when the action broke down initially. So it was good to see the Thunder just coming up with some set that actually involves all three of those guys, which they had really struggled to find. I thought Westbrook did a nice job of not, you know, going crazy at the end and getting Melo and getting George involved late.
One other thing I wanted to mention just in the broad scope of this is that I know there's been some hand-wringing about OKC's record. They're still, even after this win, and they've actually won their last three close games, the clutch games as defined, they're 11-12 right now. One of the big benefits for them is that no fourth team, at least, has really put any distance between them. So even if they play well the rest of the way, I mean, catching the Spurs might be a little bit tough considering they're already way ahead, but OKC is not going to be too much worse for wear for these early clutch struggles.
Yeah, and Minnesota lost a tough one at Memphis, ending, I think, Memphis's 11-game losing streak last night. Minnesota doesn't look like they're playing well enough to really, like, go run and hide right now. A couple other notes on this one. Snyder closed with his, I want to say his starters, but of course favorite starters. So he closed with Gobert at the five.
Yeah, it was Gobert, Thabo at the four, Ingles, Donovan Mitchell, and Alec Burks. Rubio was not out there.
Right, right. And I was trying to remember whether the four was Cephalosha or Jarebko. Both those guys have played well. And it's nice to see Cephalosha playing the four. That's something we thought that Mike Budenholzer should have gone to more with Cephalosha at the four with the Hawks. But in any event, I thought that was probably the best available lineup that they had, especially with Cephalosha out there defensively. And once these guys are healthy, once they have Hood back, once Joe Johnson is back, what do you think is the best closing lineup that would be available to Snyder?
I mean, it's going to depend a little bit on if the other team has a dominant offensive wing, but I would say by and large, it's probably going to be Mitchell. I still trust Rodney Hood just having another creator out there. Hood, then probably Ingles, and then Johnson, Thabo, whoever's playing the best of those guys, and Rudy. I mean, and Favors can certainly be in the mix. I thought he did a nice job tonight, but you have to be very judicious about how you use that at the end of games.
Yeah, with the way that Rudy was playing, I might have actually gone with Favors, especially because they need a little bit more scoring.
Yeah, that would have been fine.
Yeah, and Rudy, I mean, really, part of how you know that he was not himself is he only had two shot attempts in 27 minutes. And there's one play, too, where Donovan Mitchell had him wide open on a roll, and Rudy had just kind of started leaning against someone for the offensive rebound and then just kind of didn't have the ability to react to the ball as the pass was in the air to him. And he's wearing this big, bulky brace. He's going to have to get used to that. It's going to take some time for him to get back, and we know he's a great player. He's going to get there eventually. I think that's all I had on this one. You want to do actually we'll do a read first and then we'll get to some news items. I actually really need to shave right now. In fact, my fiance, we always have a joke that I'll start scratching under my neck when I get a little itchy, but fortunately I have some of Danny's favorite razors and shave gel to take care of it right after I'm done recording.
I was assuming you were going to save for the Twitter NBA show, but sure, whatever works. But yeah, that shave gel is fantastic.
Yeah, what do you like about it so much?
I mean, so really what you're looking for in a shave gel is something that is comfortable and that gives you, you know, that it combines with the razor to give you a clean shave, and ideally that hurts minimally or doesn't hurt at all. I fortunately don't grow facial hair particularly well, so it's not something I have to worry about as much. And it does all of those things, and since it's a foaming shave gel, a small amount goes a long way. So if you have a canister of it, you can use it for a while, which I really like.
Yeah, I like Harry's. I usually shave like twice a week, really, and I can get away with that because Harry's stuff is so good. They cut right through the stubble, even on the neck. It glides right over. Don't get any ingrown hairs. It's nice. And right now, if you want to get someone started with Harry's, you can use their limited edition sets. They're offering custom shaving sets that make perfect gifts. They come with that German engineered 5-blade cartridge. They actually have a factory in Germany, that foaming shave gel that Danny so enjoys, and special limited edition winter chrome and emerald green handles. You can even personalize it with an engraving. So no matter what you're looking for, Harry's has you covered. These gift sets start at just $10. They make great stocking stuffers, and you can even get something for yourself, of course, as well with Harry's. If you go to that special vanity URL, is what it's called in the industry, harrys.com/capspace, easy to remember that /capspace URL because we talk about it all the time in the program, you'll get $5 off your order, which is only available for the holidays. So this holiday, give Harry's and give handsome. Get your holiday shopping done early and take advantage of free shipping to get a limited edition holiday shave set while supplies last. Go to harrys.com/capspace right now. harrys.com/capspace. Let them know that you came from us. Okay, why don't we start with the latest on one Stephen Curry, whom you recorded a podcast on his injury.
So the official reporting is that he does have a sprained ankle, but there is no structural damage. So he will be reevaluated, and something we talk about a lot, which is important, is that reevaluated does not mean estimated return in 2 weeks. So one fortunate piece for the Warriors is that they actually, depending on how rigidly you're defining 2 weeks, they either only have 4 games or 5, because they have 2 games this week and then 2 next week, and then the Monday, the Kobe retirement, to jersey retirement game in LA. So they'll be without him presumably for at least those 5, I would guess at least a couple more. But the general tone there is it could have been worse, and we'll see what the Warriors look like without him. But, you know, the Rockets have been really strong this year, and it could affect their seeding at least a little bit.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see now what the Warriors look like, because remember last year, after losing a couple when Kevin Durant went out, they went on a huge tear. They won it in San Antonio in a big comeback. They basically, I think they won 13 straight games before just not trying it in a home game against Utah, the second to last game of the season. And it's kind of too bad in retrospect that they didn't try in that game, because they could have won, like, you know, 27 straight games or something like that, including the playoffs when it was all said and done. Actually, no, it would have been 30 straight games, including the playoffs, which would have been absolutely incredible. But nonetheless, they played extremely well, and they kind of just got back to the same way that they had played in previous years with Steph Curry. And so it'll be interesting to see now. Durant, I think, is kind of having a little bit of a down season. He's had these weird ejections. Lately, he's been ejected 3 times this year so far, and don't know exactly what's going on with him. He's been turning the ball over like crazy. Pretty low scoring average as well. Took a lot of bad shots, as we talked about it in that New Orleans game, had 7 turnovers. So if he's going to be more of a focus now, you know, what are we going to see from him? What are we going to see from this Warriors team? My hypothesis, although they certainly have a different mindset this year than they did last year, is that they will not be as effective with him as the lead dog as they were with Curry with him out, but we'll see what ends up happening.
It's also worth noting that the Warriors do not have even a facsimile replacement of Curry. Everybody that they have at the guard positions is very, very different, so they can't replace him in that sort of a way. And we'll probably see more of Quinn Cook, who is their two-way guy, because that's why you have those 45 days. And so even if he's more playing like a tertiary role, but just to have him up there, I wouldn't be surprised with that. And how Kerr approaches this, I think the big element for me, other than seeing how Durant goes and Klay Thompson, who was fabulous when Curry missed extended time in the playoffs 2 years ago, is how Kerr and the coaching staff manage playing time and rest for this, because they've been extremely judicious this whole season about making sure that guys get plenty of rest, making sure that they get days off and they don't play too many minutes. Will that change with Curry out, and will they kind of push these guys a little harder, or will they say, we are who we are, that's all right, you know, that's what we're doing at this part of the regular season, and just let those, you know, have a David West sitting game, have an Iguodala sitting game in during these 2+ weeks?
Well, and it's also interesting that Houston is looking like an absolute juggernaut right now, and they've got to actually win to keep pace with Houston, and maybe Houston will get some more injuries, but Harden really never gets hurt, and as long as he's been around, they've been playing at a great level. So I think there's actually some pressure to keep pace with them for home court advantage. That's something that Kerr has focused on with this team. They've been the number one seed by a mile all 3 years that he has been in command here. So yeah, I think the idea of how hard they're going to push will be an interesting one. We mentioned on the 15 and 60 that Tim Hardaway was a late scratch on Sunday with what later was reported as a stress reaction in his leg. He did not travel with the team on Monday, and it's now reported that he will be out at least 2 weeks. And that's not a surprise. That was my guess, actually, when we first heard it was a stress reaction, because you just don't see guys come back sooner than that with these stress reactions. And you know, that it's something that can linger a lot longer, too. I mean, we've seen Seth Curry has missed the entire season with that now. Bradley Beal has had times where he's missed a lot more than that. He also had a time where he came back after like 2 weeks when he had it a couple of years ago as well. But the good news, at least, is that it appears that Kristaps Porzingis will return. He is probable on Wednesday. What else we got here?
In the first game of the night, there are only 3 on the slate. And if you want me to talk about Bradley Beal's game, I could talk about it a little bit. I watched most of that. Devin Booker had, he had to be taken off the court with what looked like a non-contact injury. And it sounds like it's going to be our new friend, the adductor. And it would be, and we don't know exactly the severity of it. That's one of those things you wait a day or two to get the detailed results on. But, you know, the Suns need him in order to be competitive in games, and so they will certainly miss him.
Yeah, the adductor, meaning the groin, and as someone who took Latin in high school and didn't remember much, but one thing I do remember is that ad sort of means to you, and so the groin pulls your leg closer to you, your abductors on the outside. That's what you use to extend your leg away from your body horizontally. So yeah, it did not look good. He actually had to be carried off as late in what was a 4-15 shooting performance. He had been on fire before that. He had 46 last night as they actually won in Philly, and I think he had had 38 in Boston Garden the game before that. So they're on this road trip right now. Probably good for them. They need to get on tanking. They've actually won too many games in the Jay Triano era, though certainly he wouldn't put it that way. Yeah, let's talk about that Beal game. Actually, I didn't see it at all because I was actually making a fantastic Blue Apron pizza while that game was on, because we hadn't talked about doing that game, so it took a little break.
Blue Apron pizzas are so good.
But not as good as Bradley Beal was in this game, and that is no knock on Blue Apron pizza.
So what struck me about Beal's game here was that he scored 51 on 37 field goal attempts, 39 shooting possessions, which is a tremendously efficient game, especially for that volume of points, was that he did a lot off the dribble. And with John Wall still not playing, that's not a surprise that he had to have the ball in his hands a lot. And it was, you know, a couple dribbles and a pull-up, getting all the way to the tin. And he was making shots all over the floor. And it was a lot from two. He had 16 made two-pointers and 5 made threes, including one late that got him all the way up to 49. And it was also hilarious because the way that so in the last couple minutes, like, you know, basically that was the drama at the late part of this game as they beat Portland 106-92. The late drama was really how many points Bradley Beal would end up with. And he actually, there were a lot of possessions late in the game where he didn't touch the ball at all. And he was still in the game. And so you're sitting there going like, what's going, you know, not like they're freezing him out or anything. It was just the circumstances. And so on the second to last play, Kelly Oubre, I think he got a lead pass, but he might have gotten the steal himself. And he's basically going in to score himself. And Beal's running behind him. And so he easily could have passed it to Beal to get to 50. And he just didn't. He's just like, nope, I'm good. But then
Kelly Oubre, he doesn't play the game for stats, Denny. He plays the game the right way.
He plays the game to get buckets. That's what he plays the game for. And so you're sitting there going, oh, Beal's going to end up at 49. And obviously the difference between 49 and 51 is not that big a deal. But it was a career high for him. So you like to see him get 50. Then on the next trip down, after I just criticized Oubre for, not criticizing for not passing, it fit his brand. He stole the ball on a play that nobody else would really care about. He stole the ball and then threw a lead pass to Beal, who had never really gotten across half court, and so he got the 51 anyway. But it was a fabulous game by Beal. It was a reminder that he can create off the dribble, and he did a nice job. And also, I mean, a big struggle game for CJ McCollum. He was just, in the early part of the game, he was pretty much a non-factor. I think he was 2 for his first 10, ended up with 14 points. But the vaunted Portland defense did have some struggles there, and it was also notable because none of the other Wizards starters had a good game offensively, and mostly they weren't great defensively either. But Beal needed to carry the load, and he absolutely did.
Yeah, and for Portland, again, I didn't see the game, but another pretty desultory offensive performance at home against an Eastern Conference opponent that, you know, are not like an amazing defensive juggernaut. They lost to the Bucks in similar fashion at home last week. All right, let's see what else we have here. Did we talk about AD already?
We did not.
Yeah, he is still doubtful for Wednesday with his own adductor injury. Doesn't seem like it's quite as bad as Booker's is, but I think it'll be, if he's doubtful, you know, you have to imagine it's at least going to be, you know, a few more days. And then Nemanja Bjelica, we haven't discussed his injury yet, but he has missed 7 straight games now with foot soreness. That's a concern because, as you recall, whichever foot it is, I don't actually have that in front of me, but you recall he had that navicular fracture, and whether it's that same foot or the other foot, because he's putting overcompensating, that's not good. I think the Wolves have missed him not having a stretch four option for Thibodeau is a little bit difficult. You know, he's got to basically go with Jang. He's got to go with Taj Gibson. Markel Fultz is a couple days old, but Brett Brown said back on December 1st that he's not there yet, but everything is moving forward, which is basically more mealy-mouthed, hey, we don't know what's going on yet. And still, like, you know, it's, what has it been now basically since the, like, you know, late October? So we're talking about like 6 weeks now that he's been on the shelf. And you just wonder what his day-to-day is like at this point. You know, Bron said, oh, he's working so hard, blah blah, you know, that could be a platitude, you never know. But you still, it's really just an incredible mystery here at this point. But, you know, it's obvious that when he's shooting his his practice shots. He's probably not shooting them right yet. And so they still are working on that, whatever the issue in fact is.
Speaking of incredible mysteries, Wayne Selden tried to come back and then ended up, he's still out with quad tendinopathy, and it sounds like he's going to be out at least another 2 weeks.
Yeah, that the same injury that is so bedeviled Kawhi Leonard, and he did try to come back. He couldn't, you know, that's a very Memphian thing there to try to have him come back, and then he's not ready and he has to go back on the shelf again. They haven't changed around a lot of stuff in their sports science department, but you know, it looks like that one may not have been managed perfectly. And then a couple of weird ankle injuries. John Luer now could miss as much as an additional 6 weeks. He had a joint lubrication injection. He's been out almost a month with an ankle sprain, so that obviously did not appear to be getting better, and you know, hopefully it won't mean that he's gonna have to have surgery. And then Mike Muscala still out, no indication that he's getting close. He basically has missed nearly the entire year with his own ankle injury as well. We didn't really have an indication that was just so severe either. Anything else we got to talk about here?
Two more. Willie Cauley-Stein is going to be out for the next two games with a back injury, which also makes it even more confounding that the Kings sent Scalabissier to the Reno Bighorns. I don't know if they're going to just recall him quickly.
But they called up Papa G instead. Maybe Papa G is going to get some minutes here.
Oh, sweet Christ.
Papa G was fifth in the D-League in the G-League in rebounding. So
can we have an agreement that if we are doing the Twitter NBA show when the Kings game is on and Papa G comes in, we'll just switch the Twitter NBA show for a couple minutes to that, just for our own enjoyment?
Yeah, you know, but I always thought that the show was about the viewers' enjoyment.
Oh, I think the viewers would enjoy us watching Papa Giannis.
I mean, I'll tell you this. Danny. I promise you that if there's a game where he's like going to start, we can just do like a special show, like just for that. How about that? Is that a fair compromise?
That's a fair compromise. And then the other one is Chandler Parsons. He didn't play on Monday, but the expectation is that after he's been dealing with knee and ankle soreness, that he will return in Wednesday's game against the Knicks, which is when hopefully Porzingis comes back as well.
Yeah, I'm just envisioning now that Twitter NBA show with you, like with like this 5 second timer, like stopwatch, that like every time he gets the ball in the post, you're just gonna like hit start and just like hoping that he's gonna get a 5 second back down and just like screaming at the TV for the referees to call it.
I feel like that's more your thing than mine, but either way, it'll be delightful. I mean, he has been our favorite guy in Summer League the last 2 years, and he is a better player than he was that first Summer League, but he is just so much fun in that way.
Favorite is a loose term. I actually thought that he showed a few signs of progress.
He did. But he did. I thought he, especially that, I think it was a game against the Suns where I thought he looked pretty good.
All right, we're going to bring on Rich Cho here momentarily, and momentarily means right now. Special guest, first general manager we've ever had on the program, a guy who has many of the same sensibilities as I do, judging by his food blog, which is BigTimeBites.com, the general manager of the Charlotte Hornets, Rich Cho. How are you?
Doing well, Nate. How you doing?
I'm doing great, and I guess the place that I wanted to start with you, we usually like to kind of get right into things here on the program, is let's talk a little bit about your food blog. You know, you've like what inspired you even to start this? You know, it's not necessarily a public blog like that. It's not something that necessarily a lot of NBA executives would think about starting.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, food is something I've always loved and had an affinity for. And years ago when I started traveling a lot with my job, I'd ask friends and coworkers for food recommendations in different cities. And I'd write them down, but nothing was really formalized or organized that well. I just write them down here and there and then look through my notebook at my notes. And I eventually create a notebook with information in it, with those recommendations. And then when I'm in a certain city, I'd ask local people like the concierge or just do a conversation with a local stranger, just for recommendations. And after a while I'd build up a pretty good blog and people would ask me for recommendations. So, I like a lot of different types of food. And so, people wind up asking me a lot. So, either for themselves or for their their friends and family. So one day I thought about, you know, just compiling all the info and creating a blog. And I started an Instagram first, which is at Big Time Bites, and the Twitter's at Big Time Bites, and got a lot of positive feedback. So I decided to put it all in a food blog website, which is BigTimeBites.com. So that's kind of how I got started. When I started it, I did it with the intention of making it different than any other site. And I think if you go to the site, it is quite a bit different than any other site. One, it's got a sports theme to it. So like all my reviews are called scouting reports. And we have a rating system. There's a rating system for each dish. And it's dish-based instead of restaurant-based, like you'll find on other
sites.
I like that. Yeah, and that's because, like, if I'm in a certain city and I feel like, hey, you know what, I want a burger tonight, or I want, a lobster roll or a salad, then I can kind of look for a good dish, because instead of going to a restaurant and then trying to find a good dish out of the whole menu. So there's a rating system for each dish, and there's a rubric for each of the ratings. So the ratings go rotation, starter, all-star, franchise, and Hall of Fame. And similar to Instagram, where you can like an Instagram picture, if you like a report on our site, you can fist bump it. besides the dishes instead of restaurants, one of the other things that distinguishes it from other sites is because it's got to be a certain level dish to be on the site, which is a rotation dish, which is, even though it's a lowest rating, it's still a very good dish. There's only
rotation players are tough to find these days.
You're right, exactly.
Especially if you have limited cap space, like I think some of my listeners do.
Yeah, exactly. And because it's got to be at least a rotation dish, all we have is positive reviews instead of negative reviews. So you don't, as a visitor to the site, you don't have to sift through all the negativity that you might find on other sites.
Yeah, so your family is originally from Burma, and I just discovered Burmese food at a restaurant that you know a lot more about than I do, but that I love it in the Bay Area, Burma Superstar. But for people who've never had Burmese food, you know, pretty much everyone that I take to that restaurant, they're like, oh, what's Burmese food? Like, how can you describe it to people who've never had it?
Yeah, I think the best way to describe it is a cross between Thai, Chinese, and Indian food.
That's how I describe it too, actually. That's all right. I guess I'm on the right track.
That's perfect. Yeah, and it's really a combination of all three of those. It's got some unique spices to it. There's a lot of noodles. There's some rice dishes. It's also a lot of different meat dishes. Definitely got a different spice. And I wouldn't say it's Thai, Chinese, or Indian, or primarily one of those. It's more of a cross between all of them.
Yeah, for me, I just love the coconut rice. That's probably one of my favorite things. The tea leaf salad with the fermented tea leaves that are imported from Burma, if they're doing it right. Those are the two things that I've felt like are really the signatures. Then a great coconut chicken noodle soup as well, which I cannot pronounce the name for, but that's how I say it. Those are some of my favorites. Anything else you would recommend if people are going to a Burmese restaurant that they should really
Yeah, Burma Superstar is a great restaurant in the Bay Area. Like you said, he's got three locations. Those are great dishes. The tea leaf salad, which is highly acclaimed on the Food Network and other places. But the coconut chicken noodle soup in Burmese, it's called Ono Kaswe. And that's a Burmese staple dish. They also have a great pumpkin shrimp and chili lamb. But probably my favorite dish there is the Burmese pork curry. The pork is really tender. It's got great flavor. And everyone that I send there for that dish loves it as well. But another Burmese staple dish besides that coconut chicken soup is a fish chowder called mohinga in Burmese.
Yeah, I haven't had that one yet, actually. Now that you mention it, I will try that next time. I always stick with the staples. I love the chili lamb as well, but I'll definitely try that fish chowder next time.
Yeah, great.
All right, well, so let's talk about basketball. basketball here. Not everyone is a huge foodie like you, or a kind of foodie like me. I'm more of a foodie for you know, the more plebeian foods. I did a podcast ranking my favorite fast food items with Kevin Pelton a little bit ago. But I want to start by talking just a little bit about you guys off season in Charlotte. And you know, you made the move for Miles Plumlee at the trade deadline last year, and then you moved him for Dwight Howard. But first off, Plumlee was a guy who, you know, you acquired him and then you moved on from him. Can you talk a little bit about how that process was and why you picked that guy up and then you felt like, all right, you know, we're going to exchange him for Dwight Howard?
Yeah, when we were looking at upgrading the team close to the trade deadline, we felt like we needed a little more physicality at the five spot. And so we traded for Miles. And, he really never got in the groove here. He was hurt for quite a while. And then when we ended the season, we were evaluating our team. And in the front court, some of the things we wanted to add were rim protection, shot blocking, and physicality. And we also wanted to improve our overall depth. So Dwight's a guy that we had been looking at for, you know, a couple years, both from a trade standpoint and free agent standpoint. And the opportunity presented itself to acquire him. And so, you know, we jumped at it.
Yeah, so you guys had done a lot of research, obviously, on Dwight, going back to maybe when you're thinking about him potentially in free agency. But you know, the fact is, he kind of has had this negative reputation. People out of Atlanta said, like, hey, you know, we couldn't wait to move on from him. But you guys obviously were comfortable with acquiring him. So two-part question. Number one, you know, what made you feel confident that it would work out with him when you did acquire him? And then number two, you know, how has he been in your building?
Yeah, well, we felt very comfortable acquiring him. And a large part of it was our head coach, Steve Clifford, had a long history with him, coaching him both in Orlando as an assistant coach and with the Lakers. And so he knows Dwight well and knows his personality and his strengths and weaknesses. And one thing that Coach Clifford does, along with our other coaches, is get the most out of each and every player. And as an example, when Jeremy Lin came here, he had not played that great in his last couple spots. And Jeremy came here, our coaches put him in a great position to play to his strengths.
I always say, like, teams should, like, just whoever was a good role player and then went to the Lakers and didn't play well, just pick him up and he's going to play well for you. There's so many guys like that you guys identified him so well. Your only problem was he played so well you couldn't afford to keep him.
Yeah, to Jeremy's credit, he played great for us and parlayed that into a big contract and a starting role in Brooklyn. So it's a credit to him. But we felt comfortable with Dwight and especially bringing him here with our staff. And he's done a good job for us. You know, he's averaged a double-double every year he's been in the league. And he's averaging 15 and 12 for us right now. And he's been a good presence on the defensive end as well.
So, yeah. And then also you've just in terms of how he's meshed with his teammates, you feel like that's been better for him than in past stops so far?
Yeah, I think he's meshed well with his teammates. You know, guys like playing with him he's been a good fit here both on and off the court, and we're excited to have him.
Yeah, this season it's been as it was last year, because you guys really had a much better point differential than your record last year. This year, 9-13, but I think you're actually, after last night, I haven't checked it since then, but I think you're in the green as far as your point differential. When you go look at evaluating where your team is at and, you know, how you're playing, maybe what you might need, you know, how much does the fact that you're under 500 play in, and how much of it is that, hey, you know, our fundamentals are a little bit better than that, play into where you feel like this team is at right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a little bit of both. And then also another factor that you have to take into account is we've had a lot of injuries. Nick Batum was out with an elbow injury. Kemba was just out for a few games, shoulder. Michael Carter Williams, our backup point guard, was out for quite a while. Michael Kidd-Gilchrist was out a bit too. So we're just now getting our guys in full strength. And going forward, we can kind of see where we're at. But I think that's a big factor too. But, you know, we've lost lost some close games too that could go either way. And so, you know, hopefully we can go moving forward, we can pull those out.
When you look at that, you lost close games that happened last year. Obviously, you also had the struggles with when Cody Zeller was out of the lineup. I think the stats 3-17 that gets thrown around a lot. But right. you've also played very well at times. When you look at it as, hey, you know, this is what we need to improve on this team, do you say, hey, you know what, like, we're just having bad luck in close games? Or do you drill down more into your performance in close games and say, hey, you know what, like, this is something that the team might need that could enable us to play better in close games?
Well, I think it's kind of a little bit of everything. You know, I think part of it's execution on the player's part. Part of it is, you know, the percentages have to go our way eventually on the close ones. You know, I think we've got a good bunch of a good mix of vets and young players that I think we're in a good position moving forward. We got two guys in their early 30s in Marvin and Dwight. We got, you know, four guys in our rotation that are 25 or younger, and Cody, Frank, MKG, and Jeremy Lamb. Kemba and Nick are 27 and 28. And then our two rookies are 22 and 19. So, you know, part of it's a learning process to pull some of these close games out. I think we're well positioned for the future.
Yeah, so you guys have had some draft picks. I mean, I looked it up. I can't believe that you've actually been there since 2011. It's time really flies there. So, you know, Kid Gilchrist, you drafted, Frank Kaminsky, Malik Monk. I kind of think of those as your main young guys. Let's start with Kaminsky. You know, how have you assessed his development since he's been drafted? What are you pleased with, and what do you think he still needs to improve on?
Yeah, we've been pleased with Frank's development. I think, you know, he's had some very big games. I think the biggest thing he's got to work on is consistency. You know, he'll have a big game, and then this next game won't be as big. But he's got to work on his rebounding and just overall consistency. But we're excited to have him. He's a 7-footer that can do a lot of different things on the floor. And, you know, he's only 24 years old. So I think there's a lot of upside still for him as well.
Well, so when he was drafted, the thought was, you know, he had shot the ball extremely well from the college 3-point line. And, you know, it seemed like he could be a stretch four, maybe a stretch five. You guys have played him mostly at the four so far. But he's only shot 33% from downtown in his career. Do you feel like that's something that you expect him to improve on? You know, when you see him in practice, does he seem like the type of guy who could move closer to being that type of 40%, like, really game-breaking three-point shooter?
Yeah, I think he can definitely hit 40% from beyond the arc. He does it in practice at a high rate. It's just, you know, it's just a matter of doing it in games and being more consistent. But he's definitely got the talent to do that.
Yeah, I mean, can you think of maybe why it is that he hasn't been able to translate, you know, that practice performance to his shooting in games quite yet?
You know, I can't put a finger on it.
I can't either. That's why I'm asking you. No one seems to know. That's the big white whale in basketball, is like being able to figure out, you know, who can shoot it and why, you know, why some players progress and some don't. You know, it's really difficult to figure out, for me at least.
Yeah, I mean, we're confident that Frank will increase that, you know, a fair amount. He works his tail off, and you know, he wants to be very good, and so I think the future's bright for him.
Yeah, so Malik Monk, you drafted him number 11 this year, an explosive scorer. He had that 47 point game when he's in college. I think he might have even had like 20 points and a half, pretty close to that in that Knicks game earlier this year. But he's also fallen out of the rotation recently as you've gotten some guys back, as Nick Batum has returned. But what's your assessment of his play so far, and what does he need to work on to maybe get back into the rotation?
Yeah, you know, he's been up and down. He's had some big games as well. you know, against New York, he had 21. Against Milwaukee, he had 25. But, you know, for him, similar to Frank, it's consistency. And for him, especially being a rookie and 19 years old, he's got to just get used to the physicality and the grind of the NBA. And I think for him to, you know, see some more playing time, right now it's a numbers thing for him. But you know, we're excited to have him. He's been working hard in practice. When he's not playing on the bench, he's supporting his teammates. So we think the future is really bright for Malik.
How much of a setback was that ankle injury over the offseason for him? I know there were some reports that he was struggling with that even as camp started.
Yeah, I think anytime a young guy misses summer league, it pushes him back a little bit. But we knew that going in, so it wasn't, you know, too much of a surprise. So, but you know, the good thing is it wasn't something that is a long term thing. And like I said, we're really happy to have him. I think the future is really bright for him. He's a unique talent in the way that he can score the ball and how explosive he is. So, you know, I think future is definitely bright for Malik.
All right, we're gonna take a quick break here for a read, but we'll be right back when I ask Rich about some of the other young players, what it's like working with Michael Jordan as an owner, and also a little bit about his path to getting where he is right after this. The holidays are always a great time to look back on our year, think about our family members, but it's always a little bit of a melancholy time for me because I'm out here in California. A lot of my family is back in Chicago still. Just sending a greeting card, that doesn't always feel like enough. So instead, you can send a bouquet of flowers to express your holiday wishes in the way that a greeting card or a gift card just can't. A bouquet from Pro Flowers is not just the same old traditional gift. It says so much more. It really provides something heartfelt. Pro Flowers' best-selling candy cane roses are a great option for a holiday gift, a December birthday, or an anniversary. Or you could always go with their classic mini Christmas tree that comes with lights and ornaments. No matter which you choose, my listeners will get 20% off any Pro Flowers bouquet or plant of $29 or more. I have received and sent Pro Flowers bouquets on several occasions. They have a guarantee that they'll stay fresh for a week. They guarantee that they'll be delivered on your selected delivery date, and they've always come through for me. There's even instructions on how to keep them fresh if, like me, you don't exactly have a green thumb. So the way to send a gift with Pro Flowers this holiday season and get 20% off all bouquets of $29 or more, go to proflowers.com. Make sure you use my code CAPSPACE, which is easy to remember because we talk about CAPSPACE all the time on the program. That's proflowers.com. Enter code CAPSPACE and let them know that you came from us. Okay, so we're back here with Rich Show. Last thing I want to ask you about is Michael Kidd-Gilchrist. Still amazingly just 24 in his sixth season, drafted back in 2012 with the number two overall pick. And where do you think, you know, his development so far? Obviously you drafted him quite a while ago. Now he's had some issues with the shoulder back in 2015-16, but where is his development right now? I mean, I know he hasn't shot the three at all. Basically he's kind of given up on that. He's been decent on long twos. I mean, do you think is it time to accept that he's not going to be a three-point shooter, or is there still some hope that that's going to come around for him at some point?
Well, I wouldn't say I'm not losing hope on that necessarily. You know, like you said, he's only 24 years old. We're happy with Michael. He's a high level defender. You know, this year he's shooting the mid range shot very well. I think he's got a lot more confidence in his shot. He's a very good rebounder for his position, and he just brings energy and a great spirit to the game. And you know, we're really happy to have him.
So the other thing I wanted to talk about, you know, there are a lot of Michael Jordan might be, I was actually just listening on an audiobook to Dream Team, and Jack McCallum went through this whole stretch of how there he had like 25 Googles of the Michael Jordan of blank. Obviously Michael might still be the most famous person on the planet. And so you've worked with him very closely now as an owner for these past 6 years or so, dealing with him on, you know, a week to week basis or a day to day basis, you know, how would you describe him as an owner generally? And are there any kind of misconceptions that people have about him that you feel like, you know, have not actually been the case in dealing with him personally?
He's been great as an owner. you know, number one, I think he's really smart. He's very savvy, very competitive. And, you know, I love working for him. He's, he really cares about you as a person, and, is very committed to winning here. And, he's been great as an owner. And I can't say enough about how I like working for him.
So do you have any, times you can think of when just that legendary MJ competitiveness kind of came out?
Well, I mean, I think he's competitive all the time, so I don't think it just necessarily goes in, you know, it's not, doesn't go in spurts. I think he's competitive all the time. And, one other thing that I would say is he's a really funny guy. He's got a great sense of humor, and, he's fun to be around.
You know, so people are often asked for advice on how to get their foot in the door in the NBA. It's been a topic that people have been talking about a lot. Ben Falk wrote a nice article about it recently. But you were really, when you started, I think back with the Sonics, was it 1995 when you started with them?
Yeah, 95, yep.
Yeah, so if you, both from your own experience and then, you know, as someone who's the decision maker or, you know, very influential in whether someone is going to get their foot in the door now with the Hornets, what can you point to as advice for people who really want to get into this business? Because you're someone who didn't have the basketball background, you know, a playing background. So I think you can offer some unique insight on this.
Yeah, I would say, you know, one of the biggest things is just trying to get your foot in the door by doing an internship. And, you know, we get tons and tons of resumes and cover letters and even the internships where you're providing, for the most part, free labor. Those are hard to get. But I would say there's a few things that I'd recommend. One is spend a lot of time on your cover letter and resume, because the person that's hiring you, that's the first thing they're going to look at, and you want to spend a lot of time on that and make sure there aren't any spelling or grammar errors. And
yeah, that's good advice.
I still get a lot of cover letters and resumes with spelling or grammar errors, and I, you know, I wind up just throwing those away.
It's remarkable, isn't it? Like, even for my, when I was doing interviewing for my internships to get that, I was pretty surprised. Like, well, you know, if you didn't want this enough to even like spell check your resume, you know, you're probably not going to do the greatest work. And, you know, I mean, some people it doesn't come as naturally to, but man, like, at least just put the time in on that, you know, have someone else look it over, worst case.
Yeah. Yeah, no, exactly. And, one thing I tell, law students or MBA students when I speak at schools is, on your cover letter and resume, you know, if you want to be a GM, I think that's great, but I wouldn't necessarily put it in the cover letter. and the reason is because, like, if I'm applying to Boeing or IBM, I don't put in the cover letter that I want to be a CEO. Or if I'm applying for a law firm job, I don't write in my cover letter that I want to be the managing partner of a law firm. So what really, I think instead, what's going to resonate with me as well as a lot of people in this position is someone with a positive attitude who's willing to do anything and everything to help out and contribute to the organization, and who feels like no task is too small or too large. When I sent in a cover letter and resume to Wally Walker back in 1995 when I was in law school, one thing I included, which I think helped, was a couple letters of recommendation. And that let Wally know a little bit about my work ethic without just me telling him I'm a hard worker. It let him know about my work ethic as well as some of the responsibilities I had in my prior job at Boeing.
I was an engineer for five years
at Boeing, and then I quit and went to law school. Another thing I'd recommend, you know, if you can have somebody call or email on your behalf, that's always useful. Let's say, you know, if you know a head coach somewhere around the country, or if you know a prominent judge around, and they call or email you email on your behalf, I think that stuff's helpful. Even more so when you do get the internship, I think some of the things that to keep in mind are, because at the end of the day, you want, you know, when you get the internship, you want to be able to parlay that into a full-time job. job. And when you leave the organization, you want the rest of the group saying, hey, if there's ever a job opening, we need to hire that person. And, you know, what you want to do is make yourself invaluable and be the first one in, the last to leave. And because when a job does come open, you're competing against past interns, future interns, people from other teams looking to move, or people from the outside trying to get in. So those are all things that, you know, to keep in mind and try to get your foot in the door.
So who's the last person that you hired who is kind of like an entry level type of position, and what did they do that impressed you?
Well, a guy I just hired in September was our intern about a year and a half ago in the summer of 2016. He was an intern from SMU Law School, and he's actually the son of a friend of Rick Sund, who I worked with for a long time in Seattle, and a very close friend and mentor. And so he was our intern in summer 2016. He did a great job for us, worked his tail off, just put his head down and worked. And so, you know, when a job opened up here, we looked to our past interns first and foremost and offered him the job.
So how did he get the internship originally? Was that through Rick or like, you know, a couple of degrees of separation from him?
Yeah, it was, I was close with Rick and Rick said, hey, take a look at this guy. And so I actually interviewed John when I was down in Dallas for a game, because he was at SMU Law School. And I interviewed, you know, a bunch of law students that year. So he got the internship that way and made the most out of it.
What kind of questions do you ask a guy who is just, or a woman who is just like trying to get an entry level position? If you are lucky enough to get an interview like that, what is important for you to know about them in the interview process?
I try to get a feel for them, as a person, and I want to make sure it's the right fit. We like guys here that are competitive and at the same time hungry and humble, and somebody that'll put their head down and work, but at the same time be nice to be around and would fit well with the culture we have here.
Yeah, so it's really, I think one thing that I've, you know, I've had a lot of conversations with people about this. I've done sports business classroom the last couple of years with people who are interested in getting positions, but it seems like in a lot of ways, you know, once you've kind of demonstrated somewhat of a degree of competence with your resume, that it's more about personality and fit than it is like, oh, hey, you know, I can tell you like who averaged 25 points a game in 2003 or something like that.
Yeah, it's definitely about personality and fit and that, you know, just as important as anything else. I'm not necessarily looking for somebody from an Ivy League school or somebody that was number one in their class. For me, it's all about fit and how they're going to fit in with the rest of our group. We like guys that are, I've had men and women as interns, and we like our interns to be, good teammates, unselfish. A lot of things I look for in players, actually, too. People that have a strong work ethic, unselfish, good teammate, and high character.
So I wanted to ask you, too, about, because this is actually, it's something that I've done. I've had two interviews with NBA teams. I informally did a little bit of work for a third. None of those actually ended up working out, but they're interesting experiences for me. And actually, one of them, even though I didn't get it, kind of made me think like, all right, I'm going to actually leave the law and just concentrate on the podcast full time, because I really, you know, I want to be like fully invested in my NBA work. But, you know, you got the job with Portland. You got the job with Charlotte. Start with Portland. Like, what do you remember about interviewing there with Portland? Like, what was that process like? Like, what kinds of questions did they ask you, you know, on your way to being a GM? I'm interested to know, like, you know, what criteria they were using.
I wasn't really asked to prepare anything. It was more just a medley of questions, philosophy on building the team, thoughts on personnel, the team's personnel, thoughts on players and teams around the league, how I would structure.
So when you came in, were they like, hey, you know what, like, or I mean, they didn't mean ask you this, but were you like, hey, I'm going to be prepared with like, I'm going to have like, you know, a folder on each player on the team, or am I going to have like a specific plan written out, you know, know, for what, you know, I would like to do. Obviously, you can't adhere to that fully, but like, was that kind of what your thinking was going in?
Yeah, I was, you know, well prepared with information on all those topics that I mentioned, philosophy on building the team and thoughts on the team personnel, different thoughts on players and teams around the league, what I might propose from a trade standpoint, you know, our scouting philosophy, philosophy on analytics, organizational structure, all those different things.
Yeah, I mean, you were really back, you know, in the mid-2000s, I think you started working with analytics. When did you really, did that become something that was prevalent? I know, I think even George Call, back when you were first working with the Sonics, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, he and Terry Stotts were doing some possession-based analysis, but at a time when that wasn't necessarily in vogue, you know, how did you begin to get involved in doing more analytics, and then how were you able to convince other people in the organization that this was worthwhile stuff?
Yeah, well, when I first started in the NBA in summer of 95, I had interviewed with Wally Walker, and you know, he got my cover letter and resume when I was in law school, and he called me and he said, hey, I want to be the most technologically advanced GM in the league. This is like in the fall of 94, my first year in law school. And he said, hey, you know, I'm going to be down in LA for a game, and I want you to show me how you can make that happen. So I met Wally at the Ritz-Carlton in Marina Del Rey for breakfast, and I came with some charts and ideas, and luckily we hit it off, and he offered me the internship after the interview.
What were your ideas at the time that you impressed him with?
Yeah, one thing I had proposed to him was building a player evaluation system where he could, you know, at the tip of his fingers, evaluate players and look at different things from an analytics standpoint. And so that summer, just to kind of show you how far things have come, that summer I started working on this player evaluation system with a few guys from Microsoft. And Microsoft, luckily, was just 20, 30 minutes away from Seattle, where the Sonics training facility was. And one day I was over at Microsoft in the cafeteria meeting with a couple of the guys. And one of the guys, I'll never forget this, and one of the guys says, and he was a programmer, and he had this ponytail, like in flip-flops, like Joe Programmer, you know, in the Northwest. And he says to me, hey, Rich, there's something coming out pretty soon that's going to change the world. And I, you know, I'm a little skeptical. And I said, oh, yeah, what's that? And he says, well, it's called the World Wide Web. And sure enough, he was right. And it comes out shortly thereafter, and it, you know, obviously changed the world. But that's how far things have kind of come. You know, when I first started in the league, there wasn't a lot of analytics out there with NBA teams. And then you know, we started using analytics then, and used it a lot in OKC and Portland, and then now in Charlotte, I've got four analytics guys full time on staff.
I think some of those guys kicked my ass in basketball at Sloan a couple of years ago. I'm not sure how many of those guys are still around, but.
And one guy travels full time with the team, and analytics in the NBA has come a long way.
Yeah, I mean, when you, so you're basically, were kind of starting from scratch, I guess, when you began looking at that. You know, you didn't necessarily have a basketball playing background, so like, what were you able to come up with in those early days that actually, you know, were useful in terms of, like, you know, actually making decisions, you know, especially at a time when we didn't have the stats or computing power, or, you know, even internet, it seems like.
Yeah, it was, you know, a player evaluation system based on stats and different criteria that we felt were important based on position. And it was something that was useful for us and useful for Wally. And then, you know, the tools we have now are a lot more advanced, Steven, and I think it's a big part of the NBA now, and you know, every team's got their own analytics staff now, and it's definitely a growing business.
All right, well, I've kept you for way longer than I said, but really enjoyed the conversation. Just to tell everyone again one more time about your food blog, Big Time Bites, and the Twitter and Instagram before I let you go here.
Yeah, thank you. The website is bigtimebites.com, and the Twitter and Instagram are at Big Time Bites, and any visitor to the site can put in their own scouting report by creating an account. It's all free, and it's very easy to use, and so it's a great way for people to share their dishes and share their love for food.
Yeah, well, I'm going to create an account and leave some reviews, but I got to get better at my food photography though first.
Yeah, the photos, it takes me a long time to take some of these photos. You know, I take a lot of great care in taking these photos. And I actually have this food light that I use along with my iPhone camera. So, you know, it's a tricky part of the making a good scouting report, but it's all fun.
Yeah, my problem is I've already taken 3 bites of it before I remember I'm supposed to take the photo. That's how far behind I am. I'm just ready to start chowing down immediately. All right, well, thanks again to Rich Cho. We really appreciated it having you on, and we'll be back tomorrow with another great Dunked On episode. Talk to you all then.